Good morning. Kauai's Joint Fact-Finding Study Group will hold a meeting tonight to discuss the draft report that already has many of its residents talking. Today, we'll talk with community blogger Joan Conroe about a slice of the discussion she's hearing that she says the general public is not. And as Hawaii gains big and often upscale retailers, new brands are also seeing opportunity. We'll talk with British menswear designer Tom Cridland about the launch of his line on our shores. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. That neighborhood lemonade stand could be the first step on a road to success, and Lemonade Alley helps them make the most of the experience. And an artist and teacher works with techniques that have stood the test of time. Snowden Hodges has a show running at the Koa Art Gallery at KCC.
It's a Monday, April 4th. We'll hear those conversations and a few more coming up on The Conversation right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on this Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and you, sir, are Chris Vandercook.
All day.
Glad
good morning,
to hear
Beth.
It. Good morning.
Well, Kauai has become quite a flashpoint for the pesticide discussion.
Among other things, and we're going to talk about Kauai a couple of times today, too. But first, you know that since its release last month, the draft of the Joint Fact-Finding Study Group on Kauai has been causing a stir. They look at previously collected data on pesticide use on the island. It's an effort by a team of 9 members with science backgrounds and is funded by the County of Kauai and the Department of Agriculture. Last week, we spoke with Earth Justice Attorney Paul Achitoff, who asked the EPA to investigate and promised that there would be more lawsuits to come. Later, we heard from Kauai blogger Joan Conroe, who said that Mr. Achitoff was making untrue statements and that his groups and others make money by keeping the conflict inflamed. So now we've called her. Joan Conroe is on the line from Kauai. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you today?
I'm doing all right, thanks. Good to talk to you. Now, you heard what we talked about last week with Paul Achitoff. You've seen some of what has been happening, certainly covered in many places in the press. But why do you say that this is really not what's the majority opinion on Kauai, or not representing it?
Well, I think there are a couple things at issue here. One is the fact that this entire controversy has been generated by groups that, by their own estimate, represent just 1% of the state's population. So it's really a very small and a very loud group that's making a lot of the commotion. And Paul Achitoff is leader of one of the groups that's doing this, as well as Center for Food Safety. I think the other concern that we've seen is that since this report came out that really found no evidence of any harm to humans or the environment from agricultural pesticides used on Kauai, these groups have been trying to fan the fear and make it sound like the state isn't doing anything about these issues, so more and more regulations are needed. And when I heard Paul saying that on your show last week, that really bothered me, because the state has been doing things to address people's concerns, and it's really disingenuous to claim that the state is doing nothing to respond to these problems.
Nothing perhaps might be an overstatement, but not exactly what some of these groups, including Earth Justice and the Hawaii Center for Food Safety, would like to have happen. And the fact that the Joint Fact-Finding Study Group looked only at data that was currently available, not necessarily studies that were commissioned with, you know, specifics in mind.
There actually were no studies that were commissioned with specific objectives in mind in regard to Kauai. They were looking at existing data that had been done in terms
right.
of the state responded to concerns about pesticides a couple years ago by doing some environmental testing of waters. And they found actually that the highest level of pesticides in waters were in urban streams on Oahu, far from any agricultural areas. They also did an assessment of all the school evacuations throughout the state and found that none of those had been caused by agricultural pesticides. There were all but one, and one was due to a turf company. The others were all caused by homeowners doing improper pesticide applications. They also looked at, you know, the level of pesticide poisonings and found that 90% of those occurred in the home. They looked at drift tests, air tests that had been done by advocacy groups, anti-GMO groups, as well as the state. They found just a very tiny, like hundreds of times below the EPA threshold levels of these particulates in the air. So what they really found was that despite all the claims that have been made over the years, the last couple of years as this controversy has been simmering, they found actually no evidence that anybody has been harmed, not one person, not one child, not one field worker. Nobody came forward to show that they had elevated levels of pesticides in their blood or urine, and it's something that's quite easy to document that way. So they provided nothing in the medical records, and then the levels that were found in the environment, as I mentioned, were just very isolated and very small. So in response to that, the state's thought was, okay, we're not seeing this huge problem out in the environment. Department of Ag Secretary Scott Enright came out and said, so what we'll do then is we'll continue to do some environmental monitoring, and we'll look at beehives, which are good ways to determine if pesticides are leaving the fields. Because if pesticides aren't leaving the fields, and if they aren't leaving the fields in any large quantities, then people aren't being harmed. And so these groups were not happy to hear this because they are trying to enact certain policies that are really anti-GMO, which is what is behind this whole thrust here. Is it's an anti-GMO movement that is using the fear of pesticides to advance their agenda.
John, with the way, though, this has been playing out now for several years, where you have communities, in essence, you know, sort of, you know, ripping each other apart and a lot of vitriol back and forth, would it not be then a good idea to have the EPA come in and have some external view of this that might distance some of the information and some of the nastiness that's being generated on both sides?
I think one of the issues about the EPA is that Paul Achitoff said that he called the EPA to come in and take a bigger look. But actually, the EPA is coming in just to look at an episode of pesticide exposure at the Syngenta fields, where several workers entered a field before the reentry time was up. These people were not poisoned, as Paul likes to claim, but they just possibly had exposure, so they were observed. The state itself sent its investigative report to the EPA, and then the EPA decided to get involved well before Paul ever contacted the EPA. So I think this shows us that the system is working. You know, the state reports to the EPA, the federal level, then the feds get involved if they think something needs to be checked out more closely. So whenever there is a pesticide incident in Hawaii, the state looks at it first, and then it moves on to the feds if it looks like it needs to have a little more investigation. There have been times in the past when the EPA has come in and looked at things, but it's not a regular event because we don't have a lot of serious pesticide exposure.
So, Joan, what
this has been drummed up.
We've got to go in just a second here, but as you see that this continues, and with Paul Achitoff saying that there will be more lawsuits, that he feels he has great grounds to be able to bring them, what do you envision for the future of your community?
I'm sad to see that I think there will be more conflict because groups like Earth Justice and Center for Food Safety actually make money off filing lawsuits. They make money even if they don't prevail. And they also make
money in what way? Make money in what way?
They make money in legal fees and in court costs, even if they don't prevail on all counts. And they also use these as tremendous fundraising things. You know, we're suing against these big multinational companies. They put it out there, the David versus Goliath thing. So it's a way that both of these groups make money at the cost of our communities. And so it's so sad for me to see this fear-mongering and divisiveness that has been created. And people are suffering. Local taxpayers are suffering. And really, it's just to promote the agenda of these special interest groups. And I just, you know, I'm sad to see this continuing in our community. And until people really wise up, it's going to keep going on.
Well, for the moment, we have to go on and say goodbye. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Joan Conroe is the editor of Kauai Eclectic. It's a blog of observations, images, and writings about Kauai.
Aloha, Mokihana, Uao, Kawaii, Bilia,
Beka mai le lalmigiri, mai le lili e ugi.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13 and coming up, baby steps for youthful entrepreneurs. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a fish that's often found in island waters. It's notable in a couple of ways. It makes good eating, for one, but it also plays its part in the process of bioerosion. It has two rows of closely packed sharp teeth, which it uses to grind away at coral surfaces to get to the algae that live there. What it can't eat, it spits out as finely ground sand. Marine biologists consider them essential to the development of healthy reef systems, and fishermen and cooks think of them as a delicacy. They can be sautéed with lemon butter and capers, steamed with lemongrass and thin slices of lime, grilled with mushrooms, garlic, and mayonnaise, or simply fried in egg, cornflour, sea salt, and black pepper. We're looking for the Hawaiian and English names of this valuable edible fish, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one with the right answer gets a T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Danny Carvalho from Kailua, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Like a tall glass of lemonade, when it's burning hot on summer days, she's exactly what I need.
Most of the principles of entrepreneurship can be illustrated in a structure as simple as the neighborhood lemonade stand, a few raw materials creatively combined and marketed with pizzazz. It works as well on a large scale as a small, and it's likely that many of today's success stories started just that simply. A program called Lemonade Alley is based on that notion. Young entrepreneurs compete in conditions that mirror real life. Steve Sue is the chief lemonhead, and he's with us this morning.
Hey,
good morning,
Chris.
Steve.
How's it?
I've never met a lemonhead before. But
That the best title I've ever had, for sure.
I would think so, yeah. How did this whole idea come about?
Well, back in 2011, APEC, you remember that world conference?
Sure.
Came, and President Obama and all these world leaders from around the world came, mm-hmm. and many of the businesses were kind of a little bit sore that we weren't garnering that international press attention here. Mm-hmm. So we thought, well, let's do a little press op and, you know, photo opportunity. And the idea came up, let's have kids show the world how to save the economy. Because back in that day, you know, we were in the midst of a recession.
Yeah, we needed somebody.
We might still be in that recession. But, yeah, we needed somebody. And we thought, well, what a great way to make the world better, but to have the kids show us the way.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing that came about it for me was that they really do have this fresh perspective on business. What, you know, what do we need to do to make this world better? Mm-hmm. And frankly, business is, to me, about being helpful. You know, that's the basis of it. We, as adults, we get so bent out of shape with, oh, I've got to make a living, I've got to win a political election. I mean, this yeah. whole thing with the presidential election now is crazy, right?
Yeah.
But kids take it back to the very basics of business is because I'm trying to be helpful. And yeah. if you do that as an adult, you will have a much better business for sure because, of course, you know, customer centricity. If I do something that's good for other people, they love me, I love them, then your business goes around and it becomes great. So with Lemonade Alley, what we try to teach the kids is that we have this mantra, it's profit to share. So the idea is make a business, make a profit, earn your living, but share some of it.
Yeah.
And so the idea behind Lemonade Alley is that every team that plays at Lemonade Alley gets to choose a charity of their choice, and that's where their proceeds go to. So we're trying to teach them good business ethics.
You know, Steve, I can remember a time not that long ago when business was taught with all kinds of analogies to Sun Tzu's Art of War and, you know, crush the competition, right? And, is that a changing ethos, you think?
I sure hope so because, you know, I don't believe in it. I really believe that you need to go find the people you're competing against and ideally make them your partners because we can all do something a little bit different. You know, a business that's similar to yours might be good a little bit upstream from you or a little bit downstream from you or just a little bit different audience. So why fight? There's plenty of market in the world to go around.
The rising tide lifts all boats. Yeah?
You got it, yeah. And that's what we see at Lemonade Alley. You think, oh, well, how many lemonade stands can you have in a row that can
exactly.
make money, right?
Yeah, that was, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but these kids, we've had 100 teams in 5 years now, just in Honolulu alone. So you take that 100 teams, you think, could they, you know, how could they come up with 100 different names? How could they come up with 100 different recipes? How could they, you know, sell lemonade side by side? Yet they do. And I've never tasted two recipes the same. They're all so distinct. And this is the invention of children at work.
Yeah.
It's incredible what they do. They do frozen recipes. They do hot recipes. They put all sorts of interesting ingredients in, things you would never suspect. It. Could a chili pepper work well in lemonade? Wow, right?
Yeah.
Could they do a lemonade without sugar? Could you do a sun tea? We're teaching them to redefine what lemonade is. It's not just a sugary substance because obviously it's not good for your teeth, and it's certainly not good for your body to load it with sugar. And in the context of Lemonade Alley, to have 20 lemonades that all of us as adults who want to taste every one, wow, I can't take them all, right?
Yeah.
So the one that is like that palate cleanser, the cucumber water with that little twist of lemon, it's really refreshing at that moment in time. Mm-hmm. So the context of business is something that kids, they innately know. They innately know things like, I'm going to do an upsell. And we as adults go, oh, yeah, that's the magazine at the grocery store, right? You're standing in the checkout line, and you know the grocery store is making more percentage revenue on that. They're making more profit on that. But the kids are thinking, well, like the grocery store, can I sell something else? Can I do a baked good? Can I do a craft? Can I do a game? Their minds
since you've already got people standing at your lemonade stand.
Yeah, or how, you know, a way to attract more people to your lemonade stand. So you'll see this at Pearl Ridge Center next Saturday.
Yeah.
Where come down. It's a family, you know, fun event, free to the public. Come on in and just see what these kids are inventing. It's truly incredible.
Steve, it sounds as if they've really grown up speaking a very contemporary language of marketing and product creation, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, these kids, they know all the basics of business. You know, we're so inundated with marketing and advertising all the time. And of course, we all walk into malls and we all know retail. So these kids are just basically going out and expressing on a canvas that they already know. You know, give them blank canvas, they'll start painting. And they will paint something that's truly incredible. They don't bring the baggage to the whole thing that adults might. You know, we can only do things a certain way because there's Common Core, and we can only do this type of profession. Or they'll knock the wheels off of it, and they'll start afresh.
You know, so everybody's got what's essentially water with lemon and some kind of sweetener, and even if you have a better mousetrap,
yes,
you've still got to differentiate yourself through your marketing, through your clever name, your gimmick.
So the kids are judged on several criteria. One is certainly a sales. How much money are they making for their charity? Mm-hmm. The kids also have a taste test. So the taste tests are judges at a stage, and we have an entertainment stage at the event. So there's a lot of really fun music and things. But among the music, there's judging sections. So one of the judging sections is the taste test. And what the kids do is they bring the lemonade to the stage. They get judged on sweet to sour ratio, lemoniness, mouthfeel, and cupping. So there's specific criteria that were actually developed by sommeliers back in the early days when we started this competition.
Uh-huh.
So it's very relevant to what, you know, foodies might look at for this type of product. Then they're judged on their sales pitch. They get 1 minute on stage. That's always one of the most popular segments in the show. It's about an hour and a half, starts about 5 o'clock in that afternoon, Saturday. And what the kids do is every team gets a minute to pitch why the lemonade is the best and why you should go taste it.
So that's where you put your best communicator forward.
Oh, boy. Well, the whole team, actually. We know we have teams that are coming with whole dance troops this year. So you'll see like 30 kids on a stage doing a dance number or, you know, there's a lot of rapping usually. There's always something that's really knocking the socks off of that stage. And I tell you, when you see, you know, first graders doing a dance together, and you know that they've been rehearsing this for weeks. It's incredible to see the outflow of human capital and effort from these kids, and they really do an amazing job.
It really sounds as if it could really do some good, Steve.
That's the goal, yeah.
That's the goal. Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Steve Sue is the chief lemonhead and chairman of Lemonade Alley, a competition for young entrepreneurs. On Saturday, April 9th at Pearl Ridge, it's free. The public is invited. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Economists say the global economy is in a big fog. Somebody should tell consumers.
Consumer spending broadly is actually strong. Real consumer spending after inflation was up 3% in 2015. That's about as good as it gets.
Who's right, skittish economists or confident consumers? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
More and more station members are choosing continuous monthly giving as their preferred way to financially support Hawaii Public Radio and its work. Mahalo to sustaining members Vincent Linares of Kula, Lawrence McCulley-Judd of Honolulu, and Kent Stewart of Lahaina. Sustaining membership is steadily lowering the amount of day-to-day operating support needed to be raised over the air. And to become a sustaining member at the $10 a month level, call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online and donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school for boys and girls in preschool through grade 12, with classes in digital media, art, robotics, and more. Full course listings at sacredhearts.org.
Earlier today, we talked more about the joint fact-finding study group draft report that will be discussed in a meeting on Kauai tonight. But for the moment, we're turning our attention to concern over the report on the pollution of the Waiopili Stream. It's pigs and other feral animals, not people this time. But does that make a difference in whether there should be posted warnings? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Now, good morning, Beth Ann.
Looking at this, you know, the stream, there's been a lot of concern over the stream for lots of different reasons, including what perhaps the dairy might contribute. But for the moment, this is all about animals that are just naturally there in the community. So why don't we know about the pollution level?
Well, we do know some things. The Department of Health did release a study last week, and it showed high levels of bacteria, fecal contamination, in a Waiopili Stream. That's on the south shore of Kauai. And it's not a really heavily trafficked area in terms of visitors, but there are people that go there and enjoy the waters. But unfortunately, what the DOH found was that, you mentioned pigs, but also feral sheep and rats and birds and even land tortoises contaminating the waters. Now, the question is that a serious public health risk? Well, the Surf Rider Foundation thinks it is. They think there should be signs posted by the DOH. DOH is saying it's not human waste. It's not coming from a sewage line, and therefore it's not as serious a problem. So there's a standoff there between what the DOH thinks, Department of Health, and the Surf Rider Foundation, which does its own testing, by the way, of waters statewide.
Shouldn't that sort of be expected, though, that if you're out in nature and there are animals around, that there might be some poop in the water?
Yeah, absolutely. And Surf Rider Foundation says it doesn't matter whether it's animal or human. It is a serious problem. Fecal contamination can lead to serious illnesses, even life-threatening diseases. They say that in any other state in the nation, there would be signs posted closing the beach. Even states like Mississippi, an anti-government red state, if you will, would do this. But that is not the case with the DOH. Think about these signs that are posted at the Alawai Canal, for example. No swimming, no fishing. Whenever there's a sewage spill, unfortunately, in Waikiki, and it goes out into the waters. Similarly, the signs go up from the DOH, don't go in the water. Surfrider says, why isn't it the same level of scrutiny, the same level of concern for Waiopili Stream and other areas?
So what about the EPA? What do they say?
Well, I don't know what the EPA says, because I don't recall if it's in Nathan's report today, but I can tell you the DOH says that to do a greater level of testing would be cost prohibitive and resources intense, and they mentioned that it's not a heavily trafficked area. Their focus instead is on cesspools and disposal systems in the area, which have their own problems with fecal contamination. That's where they're putting their focus to try and make sure that the contamination is not coming from these areas.
All right. Well, you know, it's one of those things where you can't maybe protect everybody everywhere, but certainly to know that if you're going to be out in nature, that, you know, nature has its own attributes, and it also has some of the detriments that some of us may walk in or swim in, and maybe that means we have to be a little bit more cautious.
Right, but if there's no sign at all indicating any problem whatsoever, how is someone going to know and then be able to make that decision? I think I'll swim here, or I think I'll go elsewhere.
And that's the point. Thanks very much, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair gives us a reality check every day.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. You can talk back what you hear on the show to our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, affirming the value of centuries-old craft in contemporary art after the news from the BBC. Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, you're going to look at why people behave badly, yeah?
Well, and sometimes it shocks us when we hear about some of these things that people either say or that they do, or victims of fraud, and we go, how can that person who perpetrated that sleep at night? I mean, how do they live with themselves? And in fact, there are certain personality disorders that allow them to do just that. And they function in the society and seem to be all normal, and then something snaps, and these people tend to go literally insane. So we're going to talk about sociopaths today, and what's the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath, and what do these things have in common, and how can we protect ourselves? Because there's a lot of illness out there in the world.
And where hurting others actually becomes a source of pleasure, yeah?
Absolutely. It's something that, you know, whereas you or I might be upset if we see someone hurt in the street, what if there was someone who would actually take joy in that, actually find that wonderful and want to hurt them more? There's people out there like that, and it's not normal, and we know that it's a mental disorder, and we're going to talk a little bit today about how to identify that, how to protect yourself, but also how to help that person realize that they need some help and maybe help them get it.
That would be, that last would seem to be the most difficult part of the whole equation, Kathy.
It is, because, you know, sometimes people don't recognize that they're not normal. They think everybody feels that way. And, you know, you don't have to look far than what's going on in the world with people who are radicalized and other sorts of things, where you just say, wow, how can someone think that hurting another human being is a way to further their beliefs? It just doesn't make sense to us. And so yet not to say that everyone who does that has a mental disorder, but understanding that there may be some mental illness underneath it might help all of us to sort of find a way to help those folks reach assistance that they desperately need.
Well, let's hope so, Kathy, and thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
You may know him from his 30-year sweatshirt, and never mind that his company has only been around for a few years. With an ethos of quality over quantity, British menswear designer Tom Cridland is launching his sustainable line in the U.S., and he's here in Hawaii this week. But with an ever-increasing retail presence in Hawaii and in the U.S., and competition among brands, how is our state figuring in his plans for an ever-expanding fashion empire? Tom Cridland joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And welcome here. You've been traveling for a while. The launch began to roll out in the U.S. last month. And we should say, though, that everything that you have in your line is still going to be available online only. So the question is, did it need a launch in the U.S.?
Well, of course it did. We're a brand that was born in London and born in Britain, but even with shipping charges that were about $25, we realized after maybe a year and a half that 30 to 40% of our customers were from the U.S. And what we do is make T-shirts that are guaranteed to last for 30 years, sweatshirts that are guaranteed also to last for three decades, and jackets too. And it's quite staggering, really, that people would be so interested in buying our products that they would pay $25 shipping. When, for example, the T-shirt costs about $50 in the first place. So they're paying, you know, another 50% to get the product shipped over to them. So we wanted desperately to meet our U.S. customers and also to come and speak to some of the U.S. press who had expressed an interest in what we were trying to do to fight fast fashion and to promote sustainable fashion. And it's really been a wonderful experience.
Mostly we'd hear about, you know, fashion that, as you say, is fast, it's cheap and deep, it's easily accessible, and it's thrown away, and it winds up in landfills. What, like 11 million tons annually winds up in our landfills. So with sort of the way of being of Americans in that way, you know, the toss-out culture, the fascination with something that is meant to last seems to be a little bit incongruous, or maybe is it indicative of changing trends?
Well, I think the reason why the 30-year T-shirt has worked is because we're not saying we're an ethical fashion brand and going into the sort of nitty-gritty details in a way that maybe will put off your average person who maybe doesn't really have time or the wherewithal to consider these issues of sustainability when considering which clothing to purchase. The 30-year T-shirt is kind of a fun concept. You think, oh, really? Can it last for three decades? And you want to check it out. And when people go on to tomcridland.com, they'll see that all of our clothing is very simple. We're talking a white T-shirt. So it's not like it's going to go out of fashion, like it's got, you know, a One Direction slogan on or something like that. You know, it's literally a white T-shirt is a white T-shirt, no matter whether you're Kanye West selling it for $200 or whether you're us selling it for $50 or whether you're H&M, you know, selling it for $5. The problem is with H&M or other fast fashion retailers, the ethical conditions of their workers are often quite shocking. And this is the case with many of the fast fashion retailers. And those markups simply don't work. So you've got to ask yourself at a certain point what corners are being cut in manufacturing that T-shirt. And then in addition, there's the issue of planned obsolescence. Many fast fashion retailers are deliberately making their clothing so that it will wear out systematically almost, so that the customers will keep having to return. And that's because all they're interested in is profit. And so I really would encourage people to consider when they're shopping and to go for brands who, you know, all brands want to make a living with what they do.
Right. Including
but it should be a labor
yours.
Of love.
Including yours. And
exactly.
For you, it has been. I mean, you started with, what, about $9,000 U.S., obviously not in U.S. dollars, you started with what, about 6,000?
It was 6,000 pounds with a government startup loan.
Right. And you did this. This is not something that you necessarily studied. How did you find yourself wanting to do this and create something that had a statement effect that would, in fact, make people want to perhaps buy less?
Well, it started off me wanting to create a menswear brand that focused on making pants. So I wanted to make really cool pants in different colors, different fabrics. And then things started to take off. We got the $9,000 startup loan, and that was pretty chaotic because it's quite difficult to start a brand with just that. We didn't even have the money to buy our first stock order. Our first website only had pre-order pants available. But things started to take off when we had the opportunity to make pants for people like Daniel Craig, Jeremy Piven, Rod Stewart, Leonardo DiCaprio. DiCaprio got me thinking about sustainability in terms of, you know, it's not like I went for a pint with him and discussed sustainability, but merely having the opportunity to make pants for him got me thinking about those issues because of the work that he does with his foundation. And then I watched a documentary called The True Cost by an American director called Andrew Morgan, which is amazing, and I'd recommend everybody checks that out. And I just got more interested in sustainability. And when the time came to diversify our product line, I thought, well, if we're going to do something that's not pants, but we are making clothing that's durable, and we're making a luxurious level of clothing, and we're making it at a price point that's accessible to more people, unlike the big, you know, Louis Vuitton, Prada type brands, it's affordable. And so it struck me that our clothing really has a sustainable ethos behind it, and it'd be interesting to explore that.
In exploring that, though, there's always the question of how do you keep going with the same customer, because there's only so many T-shirts that somebody's going to be able to wear, so many pairs of pants or jackets or the rest of it. And if they're going to last for a very, very long time like that, that means you're always going to have to be replenishing customers. Or is that totally okay with you?
It's totally okay with me because my levels of greed aren't that high, and my overheads aren't that high either. I'm cutting out pointless retail markups, so I'm not making my customers pay for the rent of an expensive shop front so that I can say that my clothing is sold on Bond Street or Fifth Avenue or Rodeo Drive. And I run the business together with my girlfriend of 6 years. We're the only two full-time employees. We have part-time logistics. We have customers on six continents, and I'm perfectly happy to not seek further investment or to get lots of retail spaces or anything like that. So I'm sure there are enough people in the world who can eventually try a 30-year T-shirt and or sweatshirt, and I'll be long gone before we've saturated the market of the world. And as long as we keep working hard, I'm not worried.
Yeah, but you're only 25 now, so that means that by the time that you are 55, we'll see if that T-shirt that you're wearing right now is still hanging around.
We will, but I've got to set myself high standards, so I'm happy that I've done this.
Well, thank you for being here, and enjoy your stay in Hawaii.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tom Quinlan is a designer whose signature product is the 30-year sweatshirt. It's also a sustainable fashion project that encourages people to think about how they consume fashion and to protect our natural resources by purchasing durable clothing. He launches his line in the U.S., or has been, since last month.
In today's backyard quiz, there are seven varieties of this fish in Hawaiian waters, and it has long been prized as a local food delicacy. It favors nearshore waters where it scrapes algae off the surface of the reef, digests what it needs, and expels the rest. Its two rows of razor-sharp teeth arrayed in a beak-shaped mouth give it a distinctive look and account for its name. That's not their only distinctive trait, though. Almost all species are so-called sequential hermaphrodites, starting life as females, ending life as males. The fish changes color, too. One Hawaiian variety starts life as a red female, ends up as a blue male. It's their misfortune to be good eating, and environmentalists in Hawaii, Australia, and the Caribbean have proposed limiting their catch because of the important role they play in reef preservation and bioerosion. The beak-shaped mouth was the tip-off, and of course, we're talking about uhu, our parrotfish.
And Manuel Mejia knew that answer and will be receiving our T-shirt. Thanks so very much for calling and playing the backyard quiz with us. And if you've got a question, if you have a question for us, send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Aloha, I'm Gina Searles from Hawaii State Ballet. You're tuned to HBR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for our report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planets of Mars and Jupiter in your island skies. Both planets are incredibly bright and very easy to spot, so you shouldn't have too much trouble finding them. Now, the moon this week is passing through its new moon phase, meaning, of course, nice dark skies here in the islands, which means it's perfect for spotting those faint satellites and meteors that pass overhead.
Does that mean, Christopher, we'll have a shot at spotting the mysterious planet X or whatever people think it is? It's just outside the solar system?
Well, we're going to have trouble because we're not quite sure it even exists, but evidence is mounting up. Now, scientists at the University of Arkansas have been conducting a study as to where this mysterious planet may be, and what they found during their study is very disturbing.
What'd they find?
Well, it turns out that this mysterious planet, Planet 9 as they're calling it, may actually be responsible for mass extinctions here on planet Earth.
What leads them to believe this?
Well, so far, they've put the existence of this planet somewhere out in the distant solar system between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. That's that vast cloud of comets that surrounds the solar system. Now, if this planet is really there, it will obey all the same laws that the other planets do. And that means as it orbits the Sun, it may disturb some of these clouds of comets and icy bodies, causing them to ricochet around the solar system.
I get it. So you're talking about creating asteroids and objects that we'd have to look out for.
That's right. These normally benign objects that are in very stable orbits out there are very sensitive to passing objects such as planets. And they're putting the potential mass of this Planet 9, as they're calling it, at about 10 times that of the Earth, which means it's going to have a considerable influence on these delicate icy bodies.
Well, considering what we've learned from you about how a fleck of paint flying in space can do some damage, I have no doubt that a giant planet swirling around could do even more.
You betcha. I wouldn't get too worried at the moment. This planet is still strictly hypothetical, meaning it may not even exist. However, evidence is building up. But because this thing is so hard to spot, it's going to be a while before we actually know where to find it. And also, I wouldn't worry too much about the comets and asteroids because this only happens, we think, once every 27 million years.
And hopefully that next pass is not anytime soon, right?
You're right.
Christopher Phillips and another insightful Stargazer report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer On Demand online at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Just follow the news links.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
There's an anything-goes aesthetic to today's art world, as young artists are encouraged to question the need for craft or discipline or even originality. But the techniques of drawing and painting that have sustained artists for centuries haven't gone away. They've just fallen away from current fashion. Snowden Hodges is a Hawaii artist who keeps alive the techniques of classical realism in his own work and in his teaching. He has a show running at Kapi'olani Community College, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Snowden.
Good morning.
Is your style, your technique of sort of out of whack with today's trends?
It's one direction that contemporary art is moving now. It's contemporary realism as opposed to other abstract forms.
Mm-hmm. Contemporary realism. So it's alive. It's coming back.
Right. It's contemporary because it's now.
Yeah.
But it's based on the traditions of the old masters. So it's a kind of a, if Rembrandt was painting today, he would be doing contemporary realism.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other role models of that style?
Well, Caravaggio. Mm-hmm. There's so many of them: Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Raphael. Those are the masters. And you don't draw and paint like they do, even if you could. You really wouldn't want to, but you would learn your skills from those geniuses.
Well, they not only were they geniuses, they were also masters of a craft that was widely taught when they were working. Yeah?
Right. There's a craft element that I think now may not be emphasized as much. But art has gone in so many different directions, and contemporary realism is just one of the directions.
The objection to realism in contemporary art has to do with, I'm not sure I completely understand it, but it's, in a way, just by virtue of the fact that it was done before, it gets rejected.
Right. I don't understand it either, to tell you the truth. I think that the kind of art that you make is just inspired by your personality, your way of viewing the world and such. Mm-hmm. Some people are drawn to abstract expressionism. That's what they want to do. But so many of my students have come in wanting to learn to draw things so that they look like they appear to the person. In other words, they want to draw realistically. Mm-hmm. They want to know perspective. They want to know human anatomy. They want to know the things that I'm sure the young Raphael wanted to know, too.
Well, the things that Raphael and Caravaggio built their whole work upon, you can, once you learn them, you can depart from them if you want to.
Right, learning them.
But if you don't learn them, you've got nothing to depart from, yeah?
Well, learning these skills is what gives you the freedom to make choices.
Yeah, there you go.
If you can't... If you really can't draw, then you're limited, no question.
Because I think of technique, Snowden, as not as an inhibitor, but as a liberator, yeah?
Exactly. That gives you the freedom to give a kind of a visual presence to what you can see in your mind's eye.
I wonder maybe if the objections to representational art have to do with the sort of the fear that it represents a kind of a loss of freedom. I mean, you want to be as free as possible, right? That's what art is.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be constrained, but does it have to be a constraint, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, see, that's maybe someone would see it that way. Excuse me. But to me, developing these skills, perspective, knowledge of anatomy, these are the things that free you to express yourself. And you can pick and choose. You don't have to use them all the time. The show that I have now is rather a departure from what I'd done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The proposal for the exhibit was that I was going to try to show how you build a painting. You build it. It's a construct.
Mm-hmm.
You don't sit down with a canvas that's 6 feet long and just start painting, or maybe someone would, but I begin with a series of drawings, little rough sketches, develop the sketches, develop details, do so many drawings before I actually begin on the canvas,
mm-hmm.
And so I thought students could. See, I put in this exhibit are all these preliminary drawings so they can see what went together to finally construct this large painting.
And yet the drawings that precede a large painting might just be on a regular piece of paper, right? One of the things that changes is the scale.
The scale, in one of the paintings, a pink triangle, so many things changed. I tried this, tried that. It ended up being a triptych. And all of the various trowel and blind alleys are all there. So you can see how it finally evolved from hit and miss.
And miss has to be, as you said, there are blind alleys, right?
Yeah.
Do you have to sort of train yourself not to be afraid of going down a blind alley?
Well, you have to enjoy the process. And the process is you try a lot of things. One of the things that I learned in teaching was that what we see in our mind's eye, our brain can be very misleading. And I've had an idea of what a painting should look like. But when you try to put it down, what you realize was it was an idea, but you don't know what things looked like. I don't know if that makes sense. But it's when you start doing the drawing that you actually figure out what the thing is going to look like.
Because in a way, I feel as if the mind can only take you so far, yeah? In a sense, you say the brain can be misleading, as you say.
It can give you some misinformation. And yeah. I've seen students angle a line to the left, and I looked at the thing they were drawing. It angles the other way. They were sure that it angled to the left. And then I showed them some devices for actually looking at it critically, and they could see, no, that's what I thought I saw. Often we draw what we thought we saw, and it's not at all what falls on our eye.
But it certainly merits our attention. Snowden, yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Snowden Hodges is an artist and teacher whose show runs until Friday, April 15th at the COA Art Gallery at Kapi'olani Community College. And he'll be presented with the COA Gallery's COA Award in a luncheon on Friday, April 8th at the gallery. You can find out more about his work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Hello, this is Michael Titterton. Did you have any idea that Alaska Airlines flies to over 100 cities in the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and Costa Rica? Well, don't feel bad, I didn't either. But the fact is they do, and the happy winner of the Radio Files Mystery Message Contest will get 2 round-trip tickets to one of them. And that winner will also have had the good fortune of listening to Challenge 2016, starting this Wednesday on HBR, because that's the only way you can play. Do join us.
And we're looking forward to seeing what happens as we move through the fun drive and hear the clues and see who actually gets that trip. It's going to be very, very exciting.
That's right.
But for the moment, we are just about at 9 o'clock, and I know you were listening intently to some of the conversations that we were having a little earlier today.
Yeah, indeed. We've got some interesting people coming up ahead. I'm very excited about who you're talking to tomorrow morning.
Well, we'll see. Actually, you're talking about Angela Davis.
I am indeed.
And she is scheduled to be here this week. She is this year's Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals. And we're going to talk to her probably later on in the week. And we'll make sure we let you know exactly what day that will be. In the meantime, you have some interesting things scheduled, too.
Yeah, there's a new show from Kauai's Women in Theater, which is now a nomadic theater group. The show's called Wit Happens. And we like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you want to get, sorry about that, if you want to get to me, you can tweet me at BKOZHPR. If you missed any part of this show, if you want to hear it again or get another show that you might have missed, you can do that on the archive at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look under The Conversation.
Well, I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and we'll see you in the morning right back here for more of The Conversation. See you then.